What you're about to see was a conversation with Jelle Krejcik here at Theory Underground for the Film Club, which is a monthly group that gets together for the subscribers at Theory Underground, where we discuss a double feature, the one that we are going to discuss on the final Thursday of this month in March 2024 is Grizzly Man and Stalker. And so those the theme between those two films is the real. But where do we really get this idea of using theory to think about film? Well, nobody's popularized it more than Slavoj Žižek, who is the husband of Jelle Krejcik. And actually, she brings a whole new kind of approach to Hollywood, to film. And one of the things that I really love about her is that she focuses on popular TV shows like The Handmaid's Tale or Game of Thrones, and just really, really great conversation. And it was an opportunity for the film club here at Theory Underground to get to meet her and get to ask questions, and really, really love to see it and be a part of it. And if you want to be a part of stuff like this in the future, or you're interested in becoming a subscriber already, like, just stick around till the end of the video. Check out the new PSA that I've got up, and yeah, you'll find out about ways to get involved. Peace. Welcome, everybody, to Theory Underground. I'm your host today, David McCarricker. This is a part of an ongoing live stream marathon event, but this session in particular has been pre-recorded earlier in the week with the Theory Underground Film Club. Today, we're really excited to be joined by Jelle Krejcik. How are you doing today?
Hi. Hi. Thanks for having me. Very pleased to be here.
It's an honor. And is it okay how we are pronouncing your name there? Or
it's pronounced Krejcik, but I will Krejcik. Not blame you for, yeah, I will not blame you for pronouncing it any other way. So
Krejcik. Is that more like it? Okay, well, thank you. Well, today we wanted to talk mostly about your new book, Those in the Know Air, The Fear of Deception in Modern Art and in Hollywood. But first, I'm going to read off a quick little description I found of you on the internet and then allow you to kind of add to it some of your own more, maybe like an update, you know, a personal update. It says, Jelle Krejcik is a Slovene journalist, columnist, and philosopher. And she is the wife of Slavoj Žižek. She received her PhD in philosophy under the guidance of Milan Doler from Faculty of Arts in 2009. Since 2013, she has been married to philosopher Slavoj Žižek. She writes for the largest national newspaper, Delo. She published an exclusive interview with Julian Assange in 2013 in Delo. That's amazing. She has also co-edited a number of anthologies on contemporary TV series and on the German-American film director Ernst Lubitsch. Her essay was published in the English anthology Lubitsch Can't Wait. And then it goes on to kind of bring in some of the work that you've done with some of your novels. And I don't think it really got in too much into your theoretical work. And so we kind of want to focus more on your theoretical work. But I wonder if what you would want to add to that sort of that snapshot, and maybe say a few things about some of the novels that you've written.
Okay, first of all, I think it's fair to say that my book, Those in the Know Air, is not published yet. It's still being considered by Bloomsbury. So let's see if that happens. Okay. The other thing is I don't work as a journalist anymore. My work is now focused on lecturing at the University of Ljubljana. And I am employed as a researcher also at the Faculty of Arts. So that would be the change. I mean, those are the changes I would make in that CV. Was there anything else you wanted to inquire about?
Well, when I tried to find some of your novels, I wasn't finding really English editions that I could get my hands on. And so I'm curious, kind of, what is the relation between the work you've done writing novels and the work you're now doing? and maybe what do we have to look forward to in terms of once those do get translated?
Well, it's a complicated question. I mean, I love to write, and I think that my novels reflect my love for Hollywood movies, TV series. So I guess I was inspired by many great works of literature, but especially popular culture. So my two novels are written in a very accessible way, I think. And the first one is almost a classical romantic comedy. And the second one is also written in a sort of comedic style, but also it also addresses some other social dimensions, not only romances and stuff like that. But it's funny that I forgot before to mention my literary work, because in the past few years I've been just, you know, stuck in the lecturing job and really doing a lot for this research at the Faculty of Arts. So I haven't written in a very long time, and so I'm a bit embarrassed even to consider myself as a novelist, because there's such little work I have done recently on, you know, on literature.
So it's not really correct then to refer to you as a novelist or a journalist in your current work, but that is something that you've done.
Absolutely. And I would love you to, you know, call me a novelist. I just, you know, if I'm being honest, there's just been such a lapse in my writing that I feel a bit embarrassed by. Yeah.
Fair enough. Well, then I think most of our questions then today are going to be about this yet to be published work, Those in the Know Air, The Fear of Deception in Modern Art and in Hollywood. And I think maybe we could kind of just begin with a little bit about the title itself and the, you know, and the topic. What inspired you to write this work? And what is this fear of deception in modern art in Hollywood?
Well, actually, the book, I developed the book on this idea or on this observation that we live in times where people are so afraid of being decepted. So the worst thing that can happen to a subject, it seems, is to be deceived, like to be deceived by politicians or by science or, God forbid, by Hollywood or movies. And I really go into that question, why it is so important today to be in the know, to be, you know, aware of what is going around us, to be alert about things happening. And this is why, I mean, this was one point of entrance into this project. The other one was observing or finding or reflecting that there are some really curious things happening in the art in the late 19th century, and also in Hollywood after the Second World War. Things that are in a way similar, but also different in important ways. So to sketch out a little bit what is going on, you know that in the 19th century, artists, especially modernist artists and avant-garde artists, start to really... they become very critical of classical representation. They become critical of the institution of art. And you see then this movement, the modernist movement and avant-garde movement, trying to create a completely other styles, but not only styles, like completely new art, art that will not be a bourgeois art, art that will not sort of be compelling to the bourgeois taste, but art that tries to be also revolutionary and to contribute to a revolutionary changes in society. That is seen especially with, I don't know, Russian avant-garde, especially the constructivists in the beginning of the 20th century, the artistic movement that also sort of helped Lenin to execute his revolution, the October Revolution. So this is one interesting occurrence. So we have the field of art, art which is dedicated to deception, fakery, make-believe, I don't know, stories, narratives. And at a certain historical moment, artists begin to doubt this function of art and try to do something else as artists and with art. And then if we now go a few decades on and into Hollywood, after the Second World War, it seems that also in Hollywood, you can sense a certain fear of deception or a certain fear of being fake or phony. It's not a coincidence that Catcher in the Rye, written by J.D. Salinger, was a novel that came up in the beginning of the 50s, and it sort of had a major influence also on Hollywood, and especially the question of phoniness, being fake, being not being true or authentic, became a very important question also for the film industry. And from then on, I trace certain phenomena that sort of resonates this this consciousness, this also cautiousness of being fake and not authentic. And both of these phenomena in art and in popular culture, I find that very intriguing. You know, the factory of dreams, as it was called, at a certain moment begins to doubt its escapist nature. It begins to doubt its genres, its comedies, because they seem fake, because they seem not to resonate, I don't know, the true self or the true situation in society. So these tendencies are very interesting, and this is what the book is basically about, trying to analyze what is going on and why this takes place in two very different fields of artistic and popular creation.
It's amazing. So I've got a few questions then about the main work, and then especially about the last chapter, which I think the film club itself is the most familiar with, the final chapter, since it had been previously published as an essay. And that's the In Defense of Happy Endings piece that you wrote. I think that was the first piece of yours that I had read. And I remember being like a very, I guess, surprised at myself, because when I've heard this critique that, oh, Hollywood, it always has like these happy endings, and, you know, it's like people ride off into the sunset, and it's, you know, I just kind of took that at face value and was like, yeah, that is what Hollywood does. And then reading your essay was the first time I ever, you know, kind of stepped back from that assumption and was like, wait a minute. No, we don't get happy endings in movies. When did that become a myth? And so I guess that is kind of my question for you. When did film theory and the world of film in its becoming critical about deception and stories also take on this assumption, oh, we've been selling people on happy endings, when in reality, as you point out, these are very rare and, you know, few and far between?
Yeah, well, let me answer like this. I don't know if you noticed, but also there was a term coined in the 90s, guilty pleasure. And it is about, you know, intellectuals enjoying like pulp culture or enjoying certain works of popular culture that should not be enjoyed because they are, I'm sorry, just entertaining, or they bring joy to audiences. So guilty pleasure is actually a term we use to say that we acknowledge that a certain work of, I don't know, Hollywood industry is not good, but we still enjoy it, right? And I think that the same goes for Hollywood and happy endings. I think this is something that owes a lot to tradition of modernism, when it was sort of implied that the works that bring you joy are immediately ideological or are immediately, I don't know, problematic bourgeois, and the works that that bring people or that shock people or bring them sort of pain or something that they cannot really enjoy, then you are talking about art. That was the conception, right? That everything that brings joy is immediately like not worthy of an intellectual. And I think I agree with you, this is a complete myth. I mean, especially if we take a closer look at happy endings. And I have to mention an author, James McDowell, who wrote a book, Happy Endings. And my article is based to a large extent on his findings. And for one thing, he says, for example, you know, what is a classical Hollywood happy ending? The myth. What is the myth about? The myth says that a typical Hollywood movie represents a male hero who has a certain agenda. Like in a Western, he has to, I don't know, or get robbers or some kind of anti-heroes and get them to jail or kill them. And at the same time, he has to fall in love, and he does. And at the end, you know, he gets the job done and he gets the girl. So this is the definition of a classical Hollywood happy ending. And of course, happy endings like this are not very... they are very rare in Hollywood. They are not something that we encounter very often. And there are certain genres, comedies, for example, and melodramas, where happy ending is almost forbidden in Hollywood. And these two genres were very important in the 30s and 40s. And my favorite ending of a Hollywood movie is probably Some Like It Hot. Do you know which scene I'm referring to? It's probably the most iconic ending in a movie. Are you all too young to know Some Like It Hot? Sorry, David, I can't hear you.
I'm so sorry. Oh, I said Theo's shaking his head. He's definitely not too young, but the question, Theo, is do you know what she's talking about? He does not. No. So I think even those of us who are maybe old enough, we're just not cultured enough. We'll have to check it out.
Okay. But the ending is very comical because, okay, probably we shouldn't get into Some Like It Hot too much, but the formation of a couple at the end of that movie is very strange because two men become engaged. One of them, the richer one, obviously doesn't know that his fiancée is the male. But after Jack Lemmon is the actor, after he reveals himself as a man, the millionaire just says, nobody's perfect. So like the message is, even though you're a man, we can still be a happy couple. And I use this example with my students to depict that, you know, there's certainly something very, there's a relief in this scene, and there's something very exciting in this ending, but it's not because it's happy. It's because it sort of also changes the definition of happiness or the possibility of happiness. It changes the definition of what is possible. And this is what makes this ending sort of rewarding for the audience. But okay, if we go further, Casablanca, for example, you all probably know that movie. I mean, at least by its great fame. You know that the ending in Casablanca is also it's not happy, at least not for a couple. The Ingrid Bergman and Humphrey Bogart do not end up together. They I mean, they are parted during that movie. But the reason this movie appears as movie with a happy ending is because the main hero, who begins as a cynic and somebody who doesn't believe in any political action or that political action can have any real consequences, during the movie and especially at the end becomes a very becomes totally different. He becomes very political, and he decides he's going to be he's going to join resistance in the Second World War. So the movie is obviously, it was made in 1942 when America was joined the Allies in Europe to fight Hitler, and obviously this movie was made as a propaganda movie, you know, like telling people if Humphrey Bogart could give up Ingrid Bergman in order to save the world or save us from Hitler, then obviously even other people, other Americans can join this fight. So it's very funny that this movie is considered as a movie with a happy ending, but if you watch it very thoroughly, you can see that what the happy ending consists of is the willingness to go to war, the willingness to do the right thing, you know. So happy endings are very tricky in a sense that film critics love to just judge them and see them as, again, an ideological resolution of a narrative. But as we said before, this is not the case in majority of Hollywood movies, I would claim.
When I read it, it just made me think, like, how many of my assumptions about film and how to evaluate or critique them are bad. Like, that's kind of just like my instant takeaway is like, wow, I need to work on this, you know? And that's part of why we started the film club at Theory Underground, is so that people like me ultimately can learn to see film with not more critical eyes in the sense of, oh, finding ways to deflate them and dismiss them, but more really how to enjoy them in a more sophisticated way. And so I'm looking forward to bringing on some of the members here to ask some questions in a minute. But I kind of wanted to, those examples that you were just talking about with Casablanca and what was the other one? The Some Like It Hot.
Yep.
These are examples that you bring up in the in defense of happy endings piece. And you brought up a couple of other examples as well, kind of examples that run counter to this myth of the happy ending, Game of Thrones and The Handmaid's Tale. Or is it The Handmaid's Tale?
Handmaid's Tale.
The Handmaid's Tale, yes. Yeah. And So what do these films in their sort of brutal realism or their, what do they do to counter? I guess I'm having trouble here with the question, but it basically comes down to wondering what those films are, or they're not films, they're shows. What do they do that maybe most, film critics don't really realize that they're doing? I don't know.
Okay, first of all, one thing has to be said. Like James McDowell, whom I mentioned, in Happy Endings, he has an interesting thesis that a happy ending, what makes a happy ending is that it promises a viewer something. It promises a world after the end of the movie. So there's this a certain promise or inspiration that comes with happy ending. And my argument in that text you mentioned actually centers around the question, what does a serial narrative, so TV series, what does a serial narrative bring about? Because TV series introduced a logic, a narrative logic of never-ending stories. And this logic cannot be traced only to TV series, but also to movies today, because you know that every movie that Hollywood makes has to have a prequel or sequel or several of them. No movie is made today in Hollywood without a calculation of its potential continuation, right? So what I was debating and in my text was actually, is this logic of never-ending stories, logic of a narrative that can go on and on forever, and that sort of doesn't ever render meaning, a complete meaning, or it doesn't stand for any definite message of the series, is this really something emancipatory or realist? Or is it just also a resonance of the age we live today in a sense that in our current situation, as Frederick Jameson said, there is impossible to imagine the end of capitalism. So we are living in a time where we cannot even perceive the ending of a certain social order, and we cannot even begin to imagine another one. And I think that the logic of serial narrative sort of resonates this political deadlock also. So the problem with Handmaid's Tale and what was the other one, the Game of Thrones, is in my opinion in that it both these TV series are sort of the first is a fantasy genre and the second one is a dystopian sci-fi narrative, and both of them are sort of afraid of envisaging another kind of outcome. As you know, in the Game of Thrones, the order of that universe we are in is being restored in the end. So all the revolutionary agendas are sort of diminished. And what we see is just aristocracy getting their power back. And for me, it was fascinating that, you know, you put so much effort into creating a fantasy world in order just to show that there's no change is possible, that another order is not possible. And with Handmaid's Tale, which I find interesting, but what is really interesting in that TV series is the way it departs from the novel, Margaret Atwood's novel. Because in the TV series, you get flashbacks. The main heroine is remembering her past lives, the life she led before this terrible Republican or right-wing government took power. And her flashbacks are all just like, they're like a dream. There was this society where all the people, women and men, blacks and others, lived in perfect harmony. And this is what sounds fake to me, you know, because the story starts with premise that there was a great ecological catastrophe, and then in the aftermath, these right wingers came to power, and you know, just to assume that there was a time, I don't know which time, probably our time, neoliberal social democracy times or something like that, the time where everything was great and then these evil right wingers came and turned it all around, it doesn't sound convincing to me. And even if you take the ecological dimension seriously, there was obviously something wrong with a society that enabled such an ecological catastrophe. So everything could not be so perfect and fine. And this is where I think the series is sort of false, or it doesn't ring true. It rings false. I hope I answered your question. Sorry.
No, that was amazing. And that you use that as an example of how I think you brought in Angela Nagel's piece. I think it had been published in Jacobin back in the day. I kind of remembered it actually from then. I don't remember the title of it, but it was kind of about how sort of fear-mongering about a return to patriarchy covers over the fact that not only are we in a post-patriarchal situation, but that also this situation we are in, the one that is trying to be preserved is itself a sort of end of history, capitalist realist. There is no more future. We've reached it, everybody. This is it, right? And that I love how you brought Nagel's work in there right at the end to sort of tie that together.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I don't remember which, I sort of forgot a little bit about all my references in that text, but I think I can sort of trace back what Angela Nagel said about Handmaid's Tale. I think that she was critical about the way, exactly about how today, how we treat women and reproduction rights today. We don't, in a sense that we don't need this great right-wing revolution in order for women to suffer, as because they are suffering already today, you know, and probably after the Roe versus Wade situation being turned around, the situation got even worse in the United States, I would imagine, as far as abortions and women's rights goes.
All right. Well, that's kind of the halfway point here. And so I do want to open it up to anybody who wants to turn their cameras on. You'll be a part of this next part of the conversation here, which will be more of a Q&A. So Theo, Nance, and if you're able, anybody else who's interested in potentially asking a question. But I think we're going to have John. John, you will get to go first with your question since you had sent that to me ahead of time.
Great, will do. Well, thank you for joining us today. It's a pleasure and an honor. But you kind of heard a little bit before. My question is about the zone of interest, which it sounds like you're familiar with. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Great. Awesome. So, it was one of my favorite films of the year, but that doesn't matter. Oftentimes when contemporary filmmakers really want to take a realist approach to their movies, I think now they do kind of look towards the cinema verite or observational style to exhibit that. But The Zone of Interest, a pretty recent like realist film, I think this is, you could say, like cinema verite on steroids. You know, Glazer's goal was to create a film that is authorless, kind of using his own words, and is purely an observational look at the ordinary life of the Nazi commandant Rudolf Hess and his family. He wanted to achieve a sense of total realism in the film, where, in his own words, there is no aesthetic between the audience and the experiences of the characters. First of all, I mean, what are your thoughts on this approach? And then do you think it is possible to create a film that achieves total realism? I mean, if so, why or how?
First of all, let me say I share the love for this movie with you. I think it's an exceptional film. I would say that for me, the most interesting thing about this movie is the way it uses this realistic technique. So what I'm saying is, I totally agree that this is realism at its best. But I would also use the term indirectness for this movie. What do I mean with indirectness? The question is, isn't this realism actually a veil over the real thing? So we are watching the everyday life of this Nazi family, but the film is really about Holocaust, the thing the director never shows. He only shows like sort of the horrors of the Nazi concentration camp in a roundabout way by showing us the life of a Nazi family. But you, in the background, you can sense the horror of this everyday life of a Nazi family. So this would be my observation on this movie, that it's although it shows in a very, it portrays in a very realistic way a life of a family, it is really about Holocaust. And secondly, I don't know if you know this, but so we never see Auschwitz directly. We never see any of the people being captured and killed there. So the director, what he does is he turns his eyes towards something else. But by looking at the family, the Nazi family, we get even more sense of what is going on in the background. So the way to show the probably the most horrific historical event is not to turn into, I don't know, to the ovens or the housing of the people incarcerated in concentration camps, but by showing the life of a Nazi family. And at the end, what I find interesting is that he shows the Auschwitz as it is today, as a museum. So you have two displacements of the zone of interest. In the first case, you don't see the Auschwitz directly, but you see the Nazi family. And the only way he enters Auschwitz only, 80 years after the horrors took place. So you have a sort of territorial displacement and temporal displacement of the zone of interest. And this is what I find amazing about this movie, how it communicates something really important, to say the least, but not by directly engaging with that, but by showing the things, the happening around it, so to say, territorially and temporally. I don't know, would you agree with this assessment?
I mean, yeah, absolutely. And I think one of these, I had the opportunity to actually be in the same room of Jonathan Glazer, and we got to talk to him about the film with a couple other students. And one of the conversations that did happen is we were kind of talking about former Holocaust movies, and they all, especially like the greatest of all time, you could say Schindler's List, but they all kind of, they're very voyeuristic in a way, more than anything. And that really distracts from the main goal of showing how horrific of events this is. And I mean, this movie was, you could go through every element in it, the sound, but purely, I mean, the visual of it all, just the Auschwitz just always standing in the background.
Noise.
Yeah, exactly.
Sorry, the noise. Totally,
yeah. Oh, yeah, 100%. It's just more terrifying and unsettling than any other graphic scene in the camp itself. And it's something I've never seen before. It's this new take on the Holocaust film. So, I mean, I absolutely agree.
Yeah, and I found very convincing also, if we compare this movie to Schindler's List, for example. You remember that in Schindler's List, the main anti-hero played by Ralph Fiennes is a very aggressive type. He's very perverse, he's obscene, and you can see how evil he is, right? But in the Zone of Interest, the Nazi, the his character, he doesn't seem as an evil guy. He almost seems like a good father and a family man. And I think that the true horror of the movie is when you see that people who did this horrific, unimaginable things were not per se some like evil monsters, but were family men. And, worrying about their children being able to read or listen to fairy tales. And for me, this was the most unbearable part of the movie, just to see how in Nazi Germany, this sort of jobs were normalized, how the killing of other people was so part of the everyday life that, I'm struggling for words here, because I think this is the greatness of this movie. to show the systemic evil as something systemic in Nazi Germany, not part of evil personalities who, I don't know, did nasty things. Obviously, they did terrifying things, but the evil was sort of systematic. It was part of, there was an industry of evil, so to say.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I'll just say one more thing. I mean, when I saw it, I had no idea what I was going into. And everyone I've said, like, oh, you have to go see The Zone of Interest, but don't watch the trailers. All you need to know is it's a Holocaust movie. And you are introduced to the family in the beginning, but I was unsure. It's like, who are these guys? Are they, like, who are they? And there were only small details that they were the Nazi family until they came out in his full uniform. I was like, oh, they're the bad ones, but you could never tell. Yeah. It's just so long. They're so ordinary and so normal, which is, I mean, it's genius.
Yeah, it's John, this movie. Sorry.
Oh, sorry. No, I was just going to ask a clarifying question really quick. It's about Rudolf Hess?
Yes.
Oh my gosh. So that's, correct. Yeah, I actually, because I visited Auschwitz with Anne in November 2022, and that was, you know, we'd never been there, and you know, it's a, I thought I should buy something from this shop on the way out, you know, something that is, takes me beyond just having kind of witnessed the, you know, the buildings and everything and reading the museum signs. And so I looked through all of the literature, and I thought the most compelling, I don't know why, but it was the one, it's the autobiography of Rudolf Hess. And so I think if it hadn't been for that, I wouldn't know who he is, but it says commandant of Auschwitz, right? So he was the grand architect of Auschwitz. And so, yeah, that's just a little background information for anybody who didn't know who Rudolf Hess is.
May I just make a quick remark? Are you all familiar with Hannah Arendt's term of banality of evil?
Yeah.
Don't you think that this movie is like a scenario written by Hannah Arendt, a movie about banality of evil? I mean, that would be my association.
Yeah, I think that's the way that Rudolf Hess is kind of interpreted as well, as, you know, he's a really simple kind of man. You know, all he does is take extreme pride in accomplishing tasks that have been assigned to him. You know, so he is the personification of the person who sits in the front of the classroom and earns A's their entire life, but never ever wonders why, you know.
Or how.
Yeah. Well, I have a sort of question then on that I think goes well with that one, maybe. And that is, so if that's one of your favorite examples of realism that is done well, then what would be an example of realism where people, maybe they're fear of, you know, the Hollywood fear of artificiality, the fear of storytelling, of fakeness, where that manifests in the most cringe way possible, you know, embarrassing or kind of just like, how does this ruin films is kind of what I'm asking.
Well, it's hard to think of an example right away, but one thing I would mention is psychological realism, which is also part of the same trend or tendency. And I don't know if you agree with me, but watching superhero movies from the beginning of 21st century makes me think that Hollywood is sort of bound to this logic of psychological realism. And it started with Nolan's Batman. And the thing that Nolan did was to create a superhero who is full of doubts, who is almost like a Hamlet-like hero, like doubting himself, dealing with his childhood trauma. And I think that there's something I mean, I know you didn't ask me this, but for me, this is even worse than the old Batman, the Tim Burton's Batman, which doesn't employ such psychological realism and just goes for the genre of the superheroes. Because there's something so unconvincing for me in a superhero that at the same time is his main agenda is to keep the status quo as it is, to do everything against any revolutionary or any social change whatsoever. And this sort of hero is supposedly now more compelling or convincing because he's dealing with personal troubles. I mean, it doesn't work for me. And I see this tendency in a lot of movies. Like you have a genre movie and then you bring in a hero and just focus on his, you know, personal issues. He's trying to be a better person or something like that. And this is supposed to, you know, cover the realism of the narrative itself. And I don't buy it. Mostly I don't buy it because it is just a pretense, you know, focusing on pain of the main hero is just a pretense of not addressing the real agenda or the wider social context in which this hero is placed in. Sorry, I know I didn't answer your question, at least not directly.
No, it is kind of, it's also, we don't want to maybe be too cruel to any one film, but I wanted to then maybe connect it to the rise of, you know, socially conscious or woke films. And, you know, we see this with recent, you know, Disney movies. And, you know, I found your approach to this a lot more, a lot deeper than kind of just this superficial kind of critique against woke stuff that we usually hear. And so maybe that would be a kind of a better way of addressing it. What are some ways that wokeness somehow relates to this fear of storytelling?
Well, what I notice is that Hollywood is getting very didactic. It's trying to teach the audience all the time about, I don't know, racism and microaggressions. And what I find problematic in this way or this approach is that it tries to, you know, blame somebody for, I don't know, for harassment, for being racist and so on. And I totally agree that persons should be accountable for what they say and what they do and so on. But I think to really accomplish a certain change in a society in regard to racism or in regard to women's rights or other rights, it is not enough just to find individuals who behaved in a bad way and sort of cancel them, you know? I mean, this is part of the process, okay, but it's much more important to achieve some systemic changes, some changes that will influence the, I don't know, majority of society. Not just the assumption is that if we get rid of individuals who are bad, everything is going to be okay. Well, it's not, because there are systemic problems that should be addressed. And let me give you one example which I did like, and it's the movie She Said. Did any of you see that? It was last year's Oscar nominee. It's basically a movie about the Weinstein affair. It's a movie about New York Times bringing this story up. And what I liked about this movie is that it is obviously focused on Weinstein as the, you know, really horrific character in this story, but the movie manages also to show that there is a system that enables individuals like Harry Weinstein, you know, and the movie tries to be critical of that more than of individuals. Obviously, we have to punish individuals who do stuff like this, but it is also the system that enables this sort of culture and that makes all these crimes look or seem natural. It's the system that naturalizes this. It's the problem. And where I see the lack in Hollywood is exactly in sort of targeting the system, not just the specific individuals who behave in an inappropriate way.
That's wonderful. Thank you. And so I think we have room now for maybe one or two final from club members. I don't want to call on anybody, but I know at least a couple of you do have some really interesting stuff to bring in. Nance is very hesitant to bring up his question because he was having trouble articulating it before you had joined the call earlier, and he was trying to work it out. But maybe you can take a stab at it, Nance, because it is probably one of the more interesting questions of the day.
Yeah, no, and I actually think the last little bit of conversation kind of relates like with the banality of evil and kind of the systemic mechanized evil that we see in the Hess film. And this tendency to have our cultural objects or our pieces of art kind of teach us and get out ahead of us and set the tone for what we view as like polite culture. I think like right now, like, I don't know if you've seen Sora within the last couple of days, like ChatGPT released an algorithm that generates film from a text prompt. So it seems like we're at a point where the film industry can finally be fully mechanized. And I just want to, I don't know, I guess I wonder what your thoughts on that are. Like, how does it change our relationship to film and TV when it's fully passive now? Like, there no longer has to be artistic intent. And I would argue there hasn't been for the most part, for the majority of it. Like, it's just been algorithmic for profit. But I don't know. Yeah, I am struggling to articulate it, but how do you see the current moment, I guess, in relation to automation?
Thank you for this question. I am not an expert on this new development of AI or, you know, the what's the term, the new language systems and so on. But if I were to make a joke, I would say that probably the majority of Hollywood production already appeared as if it has been made by artificial intelligence or this sort of algorithms or whatever. So that would be a joke. But obviously, I agree with you. And I don't know if I'm right, maybe I'm wrong, but I believe that really good movies or TV series will still require some sort of, or even great works of literature, art, or great works of in painting and visual arts will still require something more than just a very good algorithm. That being said, what I was thinking about when you posed this question was also the function of art. What is the function of art? What is the function of film and, I don't know, TV series, popular culture? And for me, it would be, the answer would lie somewhere in that art is never just about, you know, realistic portrayal of the things as they are. Great works of art, I think, always sort of at least delineate another world. Not in a sense that they necessarily have to be utopias or show us an alternative sort of society or world, but in a sense that they trace a possibility, a new possibility where there was none before. That would be my definition of a good art. So tracing, making possible things that were before impossible. And I mean that in the largest sense possible for, I don't know, for the gender, for the poor, for the, you know, the workers. Sort of good art always makes room for all these groups of people that are living in some sort of social turmoil or are in class struggle or something like that. So in this sense, I think that a human or an artistic endeavor will always be needed in order to make good art. I don't think that algorithms will cut it, or at least they can make very generic works, which we can probably watch and perhaps even enjoy. But I don't think it will create or be a creation in this sense, in sort of opening, widening the space for, I don't know, new political possibilities.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that. I think maybe I'm in a moment of alarmism. I'm just wondering, will there be room left in any industries for art to find its place? I mean, I've worked as a photographer, and I've probably made more money doing stock photography than any creative photography. And stock photography has been passe for the last couple of years now with like the image generation tools. And I think just wondering, like, where will that art live? But then I guess the nature of art, it will necessarily find its own place, right? I guess, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I'm really sorry because I'm not educated enough to answer your question. But I suppose, like with every other technology, first, it will take time, you know, to really penetrate all the spheres. And secondly, I don't think it's going to sort of cover every part of our lives. So at least I hope so, because I mean, I don't want to be an alarmist either and trying not to judge in advance. But I do like the idea of, how to put this, what I like about human beings is the way they fail, you know. Don't get me wrong, I'm not a morbid person, but we all have sort of problems and issues with our lives, and being incomplete in a sense is the most interesting thing about a person, you know. Not being perfect is the one thing that is perhaps intriguing in a human being. And with algorithms, I think that there will be a lack of this lack, which is in humans, and that perhaps I will miss. But please don't take this seriously, because I'm really not, I don't have enough knowledge to comment actually on the future of AI technology and stuff like that.
I think though that you're right on the money when it comes to this lack of the lack, in at least one way. You know, what's the name of the old test that we would use to figure out whether a person is a robot?
The Turing test.
The Turing test, right. And we're now at a point where it almost seems like it's going to be the opposite. Like, insofar as you fail to prove that you're not a robot, that proves that you are a person, right? Because I can't get past the you know, the crosswalks and the lights, and, you know, I'm sitting there trying to verify things. I can't even do it, you know.
So. I totally agree, and I'm glad that there's some comedy in this also.
it's sad, and it's funny and scary all at the same time. Well, I think we're basically at about time, so I want to encourage everybody to kind of stay tuned for this work that will hopefully be published soon for those who know AIR, or those who know AIR. And I want to kind of just give you a moment here to say any closing thoughts, and then we'll let you go.
Oh, you mean I get the last word?
Yeah.
Well, let me thank you for this conversation. I really enjoyed it. I'm sorry if I hadn't answered all the good questions, the compelling questions. Maybe for the last thought, I would just say that I would encourage your viewers and the audience to maybe take a closer look at Quentin Tarantino's cinema and his movies, because I think that his, especially movies where he rewrites history, I think they are very engaging and interesting, and also important in a sense that they are tracing or they're sort of, he bets on the power of imagining an alternate world. And this is why I love Tarantino so much, because he's never afraid to use all the make-believe, the fakery, the inventions, or the creative spirit to delineate a vision of an alternate reality. And that would be my final word. Watch Quentin Tarantino.
Thank you so much.
We cannot do direct revolution, but the only way to lay the foundation for it is to do what you are doing to move the underground. It's a theoretically correct title.
Welcome to Theory Underground, a place for workers with earbuds who are tired of the bullshit and just want to get down to it. Big ideas, rigorous thinking, and ultimately liberation from necessity.
Research at Theory Underground focuses on what is most important for understanding our current situation: theory of the subject, capital, time energy theory, critical media theory, CMT, and the most essential critiques necessary for understanding why the theory, ideology, and common sense of influencers left to right misses the mark.
Theory Underground is coming to a city near you. Besides a commitment to publishing certain underground theorists and popularizing certain fundamental concepts, we have toured the United States and are touring Europe to promote our ideas, courses, and publications.
You've been reading Underground Theory.
Amazing book. I'm a publisher and an editor. I run a review of books. Literally, it's my living. This is the best edited collection I've ever read.
Okay, picture the scene. America, early 2021. An Amazon warehouse worker arises from the emerging Underground Theory internet scene to create spaces for untimely topics and concerns that are too often neglected or kept in isolation today. Joined by a revolving cast of underground theorists, academics, and critics, he establishes what will become Theory Underground, a teaching, research, and publishing platform by and for working-class intellectuals, autodidacts, and academics who want to do more than they're able to do within the confines of academia. That warehouse worker's name is David McKerricker, and his book Time Energy is his first major contribution to the world of theory. It was recently reprinted with a foreword by none other than Slavoj Žižek.
My Bible, it's an excellent book.
Also contributed to Theory Underground's latest book, a collection of essays called Underground Theory.
What you just heard is an excerpt from the Strange Exiles podcast, episode 23, where Bram from Strange Exiles interviewed me and Mikey. For those who don't know, Mikey is the author of The Dangerous Maybe blog. We are publishing one of his books here shortly at Theory Underground. He's also a lecturer at Theory Underground, and he's someone I've been friends and a collaborator with for over 10 years. But most importantly for you all, he's a fantastic lecturer, and it's a crime that he has to do wage labor right now. One of the long-term goals of Theory Underground has been now for a couple of years to hashtag Free Mikey. That is something that I've been really pushing, but first, obviously, I have to get freed myself so the two of us are able to do this because, you know, as Mikey said, build it and they will come. Well, I tried and I built a website and platform. I had my own app and everything, but it's been really buggy and it's more than one person can handle. And that's, you know what, a really good lesson for me. And so for now, what we're doing is moving it to a temporary intermediary platform until we are able to get some more serious funding. And ultimately, we want to be in a place like this, a real brick and mortar digital nomadic mecca where people can come from all over the world. But also, the app was really expensive. And so by quitting it, I am now able to save a lot of money. And with the help of my patrons and the students at Theory Underground, especially the monthly subscribers, I am officially able to quit Amazon and do Theory Underground full time. So thank you so much, everybody. This is one huge step forward. My way of giving back to everybody is by promoting everyone who is at a current tier to the benefits of the tier above them, as far as subscribers go, and also rolling out a new lower tier. And so check out the tier subscription setup. And if you're not interested in taking the courses or what's being offered for subscribers and you want to support anyway, check out the Patreon. Finally, just stay tuned for more information on the tour in Europe during the month of May 2024 and the conference in Mexico during the last weekend of October 2024. If you want to be there, hit me up ASAP. Let's get talking, because it's happening very soon. All right, bye-bye.